Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope May. I am joined by Taylor Ackerman, Michael Buzzy, and Randy Olson. And today is Human Rights Day, so happy Human Rights Day. On December 10th, 1948, the UN General Assembly unanimously adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and so this day is celebrated, commemorated to remind us of that and force us to look at some parts of the document and the normative framework that it helped to usher in. So today's show is focused on a very specific moment in 1971 that connects with the shows that we have been doing these past few weeks that we have titled Duty to Remember. In these shows, and I think there's five or six of them, we have been talking about what's called the ethics of memory or the moral dimensions of the ethics of memory, the duty to remember, maybe sometimes the duty to forget. We haven't talked about that yet. But we have applied this area of philosophy, the ethics of memory, to the issue of prisoners of war missing in action. So we have a number of shows on this. And this show is continuing in that theme. And I also want to say that these shows on prisoners of war missing in action have focused not only on the Vietnam War, but more recently on the Korean War. We had Dr. Jenny Jin of the DPAA, that's Department of POW/MIA Accounting Agency, on our show the last 2 weeks. And she is the head of the Korean War Identification Project. So there, as we talked about in those shows, there's this governmental agency in the United States, and the United States is exceptional in this. And as we have mentioned, this really can be traced back to the work of the wives and the families of pilots who were shot down during the Vietnam War. And so this moment that we're talking about today concerns, again, that story of the families and the wives who were agitating and demanding the United States government to provide an accounting of their missing loved ones. So let me just do some housekeeping and say, if you are interested in other shows about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that we did actually some years ago, all the way back to 2012 on our other podcast feed, Ethics Talk, which is a much longer feed, if you go to ethicstalk.org or you go to any major podcast provider and you find Ethics Talk, with the slogan, "The greatest good of man is daily to converse about virtue." That's us. There's another Ethics Talk with the American Medical Association. That's not us. But in February 2012, we had some shows on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, an introduction show, as well as two shows focused on Article 26, which is about the right to education and the full development of the human personality. More recently, on this show, Virtues of Peace, this feed, in June of this year, we replayed a dialogue that we had at Central Michigan University on this petition that the NAACP filed at the UN in 1947. So I said at the beginning of the show, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is adopted in 1948. And so in 1947, it was being drafted and debates were being had about the language, etc. And the NAACP sort of took note of this and said, look, this document needs to take account of the systematic discrimination by law in the United States. They filed this appeal. It's an incredible read. It's like a sort of legal digest of all the discriminatory laws in the United States prior to the era of Jim Crow. And so we talked about that, and I encourage you to also look at that if you want to sort of do more background reading on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and its surrounding history. I also want to say that if you're interested in these other shows on the duty to remember, again, you can go to our show resources or archives page at Duty to Remember, which has its sort of own section of these shows, dutytoremember.com, as well as Virtues of Peace. You can access all of those shows and resources. So those other shows that we did on the Duty to Remember focused on the Vietnam War. We're focused on this story that's still unfolding, actually, about the Grubb family. And so Wilmer Newland Nuke Grubb was a reconnaissance pilot during the Vietnam War. His wife, Evelyn, and three sons. Evelyn was actually pregnant with a fourth son when they received word that his plane was shot down. And this is in 1966, I believe. And nothing was heard, and Evelyn joined with other wives. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention Sybil Stockdale, who was the wife of James Stockdale, who as a philosophy professor here acknowledged because as he was a prisoner of war, he read the Stoics, the Stoic philosophers used that teaching when he was in the prisoner of war and has written and taught about it. He's no longer with us. He died some years ago. But anyway, his wife began to organize other wives, Evelyn among them, and Evelyn became the national coordinator of the National League of POW/MIA Families. I believe her time as the national coordinator was between 1971 and 1972. And so in that capacity, she files a petition with the United Nations, and it's a human rights petition. This petition, you cannot, it's not available publicly, but if you're interested in it, there's an article on it on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com, as well as the book by Evelyn and Carol Joes called You Are Not Forgotten. I did put the link to that on our show resources page as well. The book talks about this UN petition. And I want to thank the Grubb family, and in particular Van Grubb, also known as Stephen Grubb, and also the Fruits of Peace team, and in particular Kevin Settle, for working with me and allowing me to read that precious document. And thanks to Kevin, who I've been, you know, talking with through email the past few days about this show. He reminded me to go back to the book and learn more about the lawyers who were involved. I sense that there were lawyers involved in this because it reads like has very specific legal language. It's like it definitely sounds like it's crafted by a lawyer. And indeed, she was working with a team of very, very good lawyers on this document. So that's what we're talking about today, and we really, like, the sort of goal in this show is to talk about the arguments that are made in this petition, but also to just get it out there that this petition was filed, and as we will conclude at the end, it's so forward-thinking, it's so ahead of its time, it's prescient, and it anticipates developments that we're seeing unfold now. Some, you know, 50 years later in international law that march under the banner called the Right to Truth. So that is, like, you can, on our show resources page, read the Wikipedia page on it. This is a norm. Some people will say it is actually customary international law at this point, but it's like it's ripening into like an actual international legal right, but it is absolutely referred to, anticipated in this petition. So this is a class action petition. That's how it's described in the book, You Are Not Forgotten. And I'm just going to read the title of this petition. violation of fundamental human rights of Mrs. Wilmer Newland Grubb, her family, and all similarly situated families of servicemen held captive by the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and its allies in Indochina. So I read that because, again, it's a class action. So it's all similarly situated families of servicemen held captive. But I also just want to highlight that it's violation of human rights of Mrs. Wilmer Newland Grubb and her family, so her sons. So it's the family unit that has a complaint here. It's the family unit that's bearing a burden. It's the family unit that's suffering a harm for which relief is being sought. The petition is organized in really four different sections. Number one, the statement of the facts and the argument. Number two, the first contention, which makes use of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Number three, the second contention, which makes use of the Third Geneva Convention. And again, the Third Geneva Convention is focused on the humane treatment of prisoners of war, and that comes into existence in really 1949. And four, the prayer for relief, the relief sought. So we're going to go into the arguments now, and with the statement of facts, basically what is pointed out there, and if you look at this article on our show resources page, it's a newspaper article, I think it's made pretty clear in that article that the contention is that North Vietnam is engaged in a serious misinformation campaign because it has these photographs of Nuke Grubb, and it starts publishing these photographs quite early on, you know, in 1966, and it continues publishing these photographs until 1969, and there's a number of different photographs, and actually on the petition, all of these photographs are added, you know, as an annex, and so it's like laying out the exhibits and the arguments and so forth, and it's just these pictures. And so they, you know, the North Vietnam, or at some point it's reported that he dies in 1966. Okay, so that was like his reported date was, I think, sometime in February 1966. But yet North Vietnam keeps, you know, using these pictures and sort of misleading people to think that not only is he alive, but it's alleged in the petition that they're doing this for propaganda purposes, to sort of highlight their humane treatment of prisoners of war, and there's no torture going on, and the Geneva Conventions are not being violated, and so forth. And actually, in the petition, it is noted that there's this documentary film that comes out called Prisoners in Pajamas, and actually that's on YouTube. There's four different parts, an hour each. And I scanned through all of the footage, and I did find what the petition speaks of, which is like one of these pictures of Nuke. You have like the guy with the bayonet is quote-unquote photoshopped out. Okay, so it's like the picture is being used to propagandize. It was an East German documentary, and so it's alleged that this documentary is total like propaganda for communism, and they have like edited out the guy with the bayonet standing behind him, and this just furthers the allegation that this misinformation campaign is going on, and this is the root of the harm, that this right here, what North Vietnam is doing, this is the harm that Evelyn is pointing out. So I'm going to stop there and see if anybody has, you know, any comments or follow-ups about this misinformation. Like, we can spend the whole time on this misinformation campaign and like where we are today with that in terms of, you know, misinformation run amok, I would say. But I'll just leave it open if anybody wants to comment on the sort of argument here about North Vietnam's misinformation campaign and we'll get into like why that's illegal, but just the facts there. I'll stop.
I think to me, this case, like this situation, really highlights how there are victims to misinformation. And so often in society, and I'm guessing at governmental levels, people assume, oh, we're giving this information for this purpose. And, you know, it's easy to justify wanting to give out propaganda or whatever, whether it be to sort of calm the crisis or to improve improve relations or for whatever reason. I think it's easy to justify to oneself, especially in, I'm sure, you know, the middle of a war, why you need to give out this propaganda. But I think this case really shows that there are victims to that propaganda. Even when it's trying to show that, you know, your side isn't evil and that you are trying to do X, Y, Z, it really does show that there are victims. And that's the families who get that misinformation in this case.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And I'll say more about that. So, yeah, there are victims. So there's this harm, and this harm is being perpetrated on actual people, and in particular families. And so we'll go into that more deeply, but anybody else on the statement of facts?
I was going to piggyback off of what Taylor said, and that to sort of characterize this harm as, you know, I think one paramount facet of that would just be the mental distress that comes from not knowing. He was shot down on January 26, 1966, and then it was years of these photos slowly coming out, which gives the false impression of him being alive when in fact he had died 9 days after he'd been shot down. And so just not having proper communication between Evelyn Grubb and her family with her husband, and the mental distress that causes an individual, and the anxiety and the fear and the doubt that persists for years, I think is really indicative of why this right to truth is so important to help remedy and relieve that.
Yeah. And it's individual and olds. I mean, it's the family. And there's a really interesting part of the petition where she notes that this is the head of the household. Like, this is not just, you know, any old, like, it's the head of the household, and that's an even, like, higher mental distress level when you're uncertain about that. And as we've, like, briefly touched on in earlier shows where we talked about Evelyn Grubb with Jeff Grubb, one of her sons, you know, the sort of gender role at the time, it was like because the status was uncertain, there are certain things she couldn't do. She couldn't get a credit card. And this is, like, her and other women suffered these things because there's this, like, ambiguous status of their husbands. And the legal framework of the time needs, you know, certainty or nothing. And so the reading that I've done for this show, you know, the American Bar Association was involved in changing legislation state to state to help these families. So, yeah, it's Evelyn suffering. It's the son's suffering. It's the son who, you know, never knew his father. So this continues. Randy, anything?
Yeah, I mean, and I suspect we'll go into it more later, but the thing that's really striking to me is the idea that, you know, the country whom a soldier is going to war against has responsibilities to that soldier, despite the fact that they're an enemy. Like, that's the world we live in. And, you know, I think later I'd like to dive into, like, the actual etymology of this right to truth and, like, talk about a little bit, like, where it's coming from and where it's not, because I feel like that's somewhere to go, but not yet.
Yeah, and I think also your comment connects to, like, this whole idea of, like, there are duties to the soldiers against whom one is fighting. That's, you know, the Geneva Convention. Third Geneva Convention is absolutely on point with that comment, and that's in the second contention, which we'll get to. But the first contention, okay, so there are two important documents of international law here, and I should say public international law, if you really want to get precise. And one is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the second is the Third Geneva Convention. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the very first sentence mentions the human family, and that is referred to in the petition. It's just recognized that this human family is the basis of human rights and just treatment by governments. And the petition focuses on Article 16, Sub 3. And you can look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a quick read. It's a one pager. I think it's 20. No, I forget how many articles it is. But it's a very quick read. Superficially, of course, to really understand what the articles are doing requires some time. There's an excellent book called A World Made New by Marianne Glendon. We have played clips of Marianne Glendon on this show before, and if you're interested in the history of the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I direct you to that excellent book. But Article 16 says, or 16 sub 3, the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. So this family unit is the fundamental unit of society, and the state owes it, has a duty to protect it. So in philosophy, when we talk about rights and duties, there's a distinction made between negative rights and positive rights, where a negative right is simply, and every right implies a duty, always. That's my philosophy. Some people I think will disagree. But a negative right implies a duty of the state not to interfere, so to leave you alone, whereas a positive right imposes on the state a duty to do something, to give you something. And so the way that the petition proceeds is to really outline what we call a positive human right or a positive duty of the state to provide information. So this is, again, the right to truth that allows the family to have certainty about whether one's family member is alive or dead. So again, like here's the sentence. It says, Article 16.3, the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection. So what does that protection consist in? At the very least, the right to provide information that gives certainty about the life or death of a family member. So that's the argument. I'll stop there and just leave it open. We'll just go around in alphabetical order. If you have nothing to say, just say pass, and I'll start with Taylor.
Yeah, I feel like this is almost intuitive. Like, it's that idea of natural law of, like, yes, it's ingrained in positive law, positive public international law, but also I think intuitively I know when I've had family members, things happen to them, and I know somebody forgets to tell me or something, I get irritated, right? And I think that's a pretty universal experience. We want to know that our family members are okay and safe and healthy, and it's almost just innate. And I think also the conception of family is broader than just biological, and I just want to make that note as well. And I think it's recognized in law, too. But, yeah, I think it's intuitive, and it's intuitive in national legal systems. People have a right to know what happens to their family members in different medical systems. I don't know. I think it's this intuitive idea, and we've put it on paper, and the fact that it wasn't exercised in this case, despite it being this intuitive human norm of like a desire to know one's family member, it kind of really highlights how much this is a human rights violation. Because I think anyone can relate to like the feeling of not knowing what's happening to a family member is quite scary.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Michael?
Yeah, I think, Hope, when you were talking about Article 16 of the UDHR and how that subsection 3 is sort of the basis for where truth comes from, and then we can look further ahead in time to, in 1977, Protocol 1 to the Geneva Convention enshrined a right for families of people killed in armed conflicts to find out what happened to their relatives, to sort of see where this work that they were doing with Evelyn Grubb's petition ended up years later and finally sort of establishing that there is this right for individuals who are involved in armed conflicts to know the truth of what happens to their relatives. And to go back to our first discussion earlier, that sort of serves as the remedy to the mental distress that individuals endure through not knowing. And I completely agree with what Taylor said, that when she put it in those amazing terms of just being able to relate on a very human level between, you know, wanting to know the truth from relatives and the sort of discomfort and othering that you might feel when you are excluded from that and the mental distress that comes with that. I thought that was a really good way to go about framing what may seem like a off the bat, a really complex issue.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And Randy?
I'm very interested in the fact that the family unit seems to be this bridge between two entire like world philosophies that, like, you know, in the West we have this hyper concentration on the individual and the rights of the individual and the duties of the individual, and that's like this main driving engine. And then, you know, in sort of Eastern philosophy, there's this tilt towards the collective, the community, the, you know, the we before the I. And it's amazing because the family unit seems to be the kind of, you know, middle place, bridging that gap. Hmm. And I mean, I don't know, there's a lot I could say about that, but simply pointing it out is my objective now.
Cool. And I just want to follow up with what Taylor said about, the family is not necessarily your biological family. I think that's, an important piece to remember. The right, I think it's the right to intimate association that the United States Supreme Court in various decisions has recognized is really important. And this sort of bridges Taylor's comment with what you just said, Randy. Like, there's language that you'll see that this right of intimate association is this fundamental right, who you share your deepest self with, who you're intimate with, and so forth, because the self is constructed through these intimate associations. They're so formative to who we are and who we become, and in the project of autonomy and so forth, we have to have, this latitude as to who we associate ourselves with intimately. And so you see language like that coming out of various decisions at the United States Supreme Court, this right of intimate association. So I think when we focus on that, we can sort of, see that's it's this family thing, but it's how the others and significant others are formative into one's self, one's values, and one's traumas as well. Because a family is can also be a place of, great wounding. But in any case, that's, how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is brought up in this petition. So it's just like, here you go, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights like recognizes the importance of the family, that it's allowed protection, and that includes, at the very least, this right to know with certainty about whether one's loved one is dead or alive. The second contention, as we said before, involves the Third Geneva Convention, and this convention concerns the inhumane treatment of prisoners of war. And the contention focuses on, again, a very specific article. This is what legal documents do. They focus on very specific articles, sentences, and so forth. So it's Article 120 of the Third Geneva Convention. You can look it up, Google it. And this concerns the death of prisoners of war. And it's noted there in that article that the country holding the POW has to furnish a death certificate, and this sort of like formal information needs to be sent to what's called the Central Information Agency. So there's like a sort of information clearinghouse, and if, you know, you have a prisoner of war and they die, you have to submit, you know, this. And actually, if you look at the Geneva Convention, Article 120, if you scroll to the end of the Third Geneva Convention, there's actually like a sample form that's provided. So this kind of paperwork needs to be done. So the argument continues, you know, says, look, there's this provision of the Geneva Convention. You have to provide a kind of like death certificate. And I'm just going to read a little bit. This is language from the petition. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically the petition, so interestingly, we've been talking about like the mental distress of the family members of that comes from not knowing. So the petition, focusing on this article, focuses on the mental distress of the prisoner. Okay, so this is in the petition, it's not in the Geneva Convention, and it says, while a prisoner is alive, he has the right to expect that in the event of death, it will be reported in a manner that notifies his family in humane and certain terms, so that the burden of concern that his family may live in constant mental anguish and torture is not added to the normal burden of captivity. So the prisoner, this is saying, has this like burden of he's being captive and he's a prisoner. So there's like that physical burdening, but then there's this, you know, the prisoner's own mental anguish about his family not knowing. So the petition, you know, distinguishes these two different burdens, the burden of concern and the burden of captivity. And then it says, after a prisoner has died, the right shifts to the living who alone can vindicate it. So what is that right? The right to expect that this information will be transmitted. And so when he dies, that right doesn't die with him. That right to expect goes to the family. And so therefore, this is sort of like, you know, a very elegant way of going very deeply into, well, what's really the sort of like metaphysics and, you know, psychological substance of this, like, why do we have a death certificate? And, well, we have a death certificate so that the prisoner knows that his family will know, and then his mental anguish will be alleviated, and then their mental anguish will be alleviated when they get that certificate. So I will leave it open. We'll go backwards this time, and we'll start with Randy, and if you have nothing to say, you can just say pass.
Well, you know, there's a lot that could be said. I think it's interesting that these contracts all seem to emerge providing for various kinds of alleviations of suffering for people that, you know, like I just can't imagine 500 years ago this kind of thing existing. But for some reason today, it seems like it's obviously supposed to be a thing. And I don't know how to reconcile that right now. So that's all.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a thing now because, you know, of this unbearable burden that's being shouldered by the families. And this, you know, has to do with war that, like, and again, like Bertha von Suttner, what does she do? She exposes the effects of war on the family for the very first time in history, and that's in 1889. And it's like exposing what this thing is doing, and instead of like using language like honor, glory, patriotism, focus on the anguish that it's creating on the family. So there's first like drawing attention to that, but then of course like women organizing and demanding better from their country, and from quite frankly the documents, the instruments that already exist, right? So, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
back to you.
Just building on it a little, like it's very interesting to me that these things emerge out of the progression that we've made as a civilization, like something to do with the fact that people are able to communicate more effectively and more efficiently creates this expectation. Because like, if your spouse was going off on the Crusades, I don't think that there was this expectation that you would know one way or the other. But now, because we can communicate instantly and effectively, like, or the fact that like we can rely on a postal service, like that's a new thing, all things considered with respect to humans, like that's a new thing. And with that new capacity, we develop these new expectations. And I don't know, that's all.
I see. And I'll just say like, at least, what is it? The Trojan women, you know, there's a cycle of Greek tragedies that, where like, and even in the Iliad, you know, you have women like pleading their husbands not to go to war. So there's still like this sort of pain that's being expressed. And, you know, I do think that, 1920 and women getting a political voice so that it's actually like legitimate to like make a complaint has something to do with why the shift, the evolution has happened. Without that legitimacy, without like a formal political voice, the government is just like, you're annihilated, you don't exist. So I think that's a connection, because as we've said on the show, you know, it's like these women during the Vietnam War, who like they demand better, and they're told to keep quiet, and they don't. And they're able to do that because of some sort of, you know, role that they can play in the laws under which they live. So, Michael.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me from the information you were giving out a little bit ago was that I think the right to truth has a lot to do with healing, that truth heals in a way. And there's this duality there where the soldier and the family are both suffering immensely, you know, mental distress, anxiety, what have you. And that even though the soldier might, like the risk of perishing in their environment is very high, that to a degree, their mental sort, the things that plague them mentally, the anxiety, the distress of their family not knowing what's happening to them, are alleviated slightly through knowledge that their family will know the truth of what happened to them. And then I think that would even go a long way on the family side as well, where, you know, you could have this bedrock belief that regardless of how the circumstance thing plays out for us, that we will know in the end what has happened. And I think that goes a long way in making a very painful process less so, in a way that you could have that certainty within yourself that it will, what we seek will come to fruition. And once it does, that true healing can begin because you're coming from a place that is truthful.
Yeah, and I'll add to that I forget the number. I don't know, it's like 80,000 are still unaccounted for. And there are people who die, you know, families who die without, you know, without that information, if you will. And so I would just, yeah, follow your remarks up by saying, like, even if you don't have, you know, that they don't find your body or whatever it is, like, knowing that there is an entity, the DPAA, as well as other, you know, private organizations, there's some solace in that. So, yeah, there are many, you know, like I said, many families who don't, like, they go to their graves without that closure. And so I think, although it's not, you know, complete healing, that I think there's some solace in knowing that this work is being done to try to, yeah, find. So, Taylor.
So I guess going off the point of it being this form of solace, and sort of mitigating the effects of war on individuals, I think that comes down to sort of the golden rule that we spoke about previously on this podcast, and sort of how, you know, when Randy was talking about how it seems so obvious now that this should occur, you know, because it's like with technology, it's feasible and it wouldn't have been possible previously. But it's sort of, like I said previously, intuitive, but there's this desire by the family that there's this right to this information, there's this right to truth, that it seems obvious that this would occur. And the fact that what's so amazing about it is the fact that they've been to words and they made it international law, because they have the ability to do that now. They can, you know, we don't have to have people live in sort of this state of or a lack of healing. They can heal and they can get this information. But even though we have these mechanisms that we put in place in terms of these conventions and different entities, the mechanisms weren't working as well at the time when Evelyn filed the petition. And I think, I guess what I'm saying is, I think Evelyn, in a way, and these families, when they're asserting their rights, and when people are asserting their rights, are kind of creating norms and creating mechanisms and creating laws for future generations. And I think that needs to be recognized, how important this petition was and how important other petitions and other families asserting their rights are. Because without sort of that assertion of rights and without people saying this has affected me, it's just going to keep affecting people for generations and generations. And sort of, it's incredible that we have the Third Geneva Convention and the UDHR and then later the ICCPR, but the fact that she asserted her claim and her right is also, like, incredibly important, and the conventions themselves wouldn't mean as much, and the existence of the right wouldn't mean as much if we didn't have families coming forward and saying, I need to know this information.
Cool. Does anybody have any follow-up to that comment? Yeah, because, you know, like, making the claim, that's what you're taught, like, the importance of, like, making the claim. That just, you know, raises our consciousness and, like, create, like, it's just, it's helping us to think and move and evolve. But, like, pointing to, you know, this document, and by the way, Eleanor Roosevelt, who's, you know, extremely influential, instrumental in having the Universal Declaration of Human Rights be adopted at all, like, it was really a labor of love for her. She really stressed the importance of doing something on Human Rights Day, and there's this, I think it's called Making Human Rights Come Alive, and it's like, study the document, like, know what it says, discuss it with your family. And in doing this, you know, like, just making the argument, it's reminding us that there is this thing, that there is this article that mentions families. And by the way, I'm going to breathe life into it by sort of spelling out what protection looks like, because that's a very broad and vague thing, protection by society and the state. What does that really consist in? What are the specific actions that consists in? And so in making this claim, she's getting very, very specific and helping us to think. That's how I think about it. Anybody else on this point about the importance of making the claim? Yeah, the sort of genius of that. And this was her idea. So it was Evelyn's idea to do this. The details of the argument, you know, she used a team of lawyers, but to make the claim to the international community, like, and she floated that by lawyers, and they're like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let us help you. And she worked with them. So they would meet and have these discussions. And but the idea definitely came from her to sort of invoke this machinery of international law and norms. So let's, I guess, finish up. Any other remarks on the importance of making of the claim? Going once, twice, thrice. Okay. Any final remarks on the Geneva Convention? Third Geneva Convention, second contention.
Okay. Yeah, I mean...
Okay, go ahead.
So, to be clear, this is the part that's referring to a certified copy of the death certificate should be transmitted to the Central Information Agency part.
That's the part. Article 120, Section 3.
Yeah, so I find this part to be really... It's an interesting requirement because it's presupposing a couple things that I definitely want to unpack a little. And I don't have like the final answer on this one. It's an open question for me, but like we've civilized conflict to such an incredible degree that we can start to lay claims on both, you know, both parts, both people in a conflict. And that's like the whole point of laws of war. But it goes all the way to, like, just soldier by soldier. And I think that there's a conceptual jump there because we're dealing with, okay, the soldier has certain rights which impose duties on his government or his or her own government. But then that also seems to apply to other even enemies. And that's the thing that I said earlier and I want to dive back into because
okay.
It's counterintuitive to me, and it points to something specific, namely that these rights, they're not emerging, they're not like a natural thing. It's not, let me use a different word there. They're not built into the fabric of the universe. They're something that emerges out of our civilization. And I think that there's an important distinction there because when we use terms like natural law, which is, as far as I can tell, what this would be packaged into when we ask ourselves where or how such a right would emerge or how such a condition would emerge, it's really fascinating to me to realize that, well, if a person gets lost in the, you know, in the woods, family doesn't get information from the trees about it, right? It's like, but there's something about the fact that there's a conflict that a person is signing up for as part of, a citizen is making a contract with his government, and that government has these responsibilities. And through those contracts, things emerge out of necessity, and one of them has to do with all these rights of the family.
Mm-hmm. Is that a period?
Well, it's like a dot, 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 you know.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Anybody want to respond to that? Going once, twice, thrice. So, again, like... And this was brought up briefly when we spoke to Dr. Jenny Jin of the DPAA. This book, I think it's called This Republic of Suffering by Drew Gilpin Faust, who looks at the Civil War, the sort of how the Civil War shaped this country. And she, in that book, says things like, there was no system. There was no system of accounting. There were no dog tags. Like, dog tags, they just, like, the states didn't really think of the family. It's just, at all. It just wasn't a concern because they're looking at soldiers as cannon fodder. They're not even looking at, like, it's just this kind of duties don't really exist at the outset. And so these things come through a process of agitation. And so, yeah, it's sort of like female nurses on the battlefield who are starting to pin information to the bodies and things like this. So I would just say that the state is not, you know, so empathic. There's a quote that I've read many times by Bertha von Suttner, something like, the state will become more human when the essentially female qualities of gentleness and dignity penetrate political life. It's something like that. But anyway, it's sort of like families, i.e. women, because, you know, females were not fighting in these wars, who are, you know, trying, like, moving the state to be more, I don't know, like, recognizing that other people exist. I mean, not to be sarcastic, yeah. But, you know, and, you know, that's Bertha's thing, that, look, there's this whole unit that you're harming called the family. And, like, you know, like, you should account for that. And again, this is like the first time anyone ever makes such an argument. And actually that book was turned down by the original publishers, quote unquote, because it was, quote, offensive to make such an argument. I swear to God, it was offensive to make that argument. Okay.
That's,
yeah.
That's offensive.
I mean, yeah, right. It makes you question, you know, the legitimacy of terms like offensive. But in any case, yeah, I just want to, like, I don't know if I'm responding or, like, the dot, dot, dot is leading to more thoughts or we're just going around in circles.
Yeah.
I open it up to anyone to jump in. Go ahead. Yeah, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, something's come to mind for me along this vein of conversation. You know, we're talking of, and, like, it just strikes me as so, I guess, you know, kind of an interesting a little quirk of the human condition in the modern era, I guess. You know, we're talking about this right to truth and the duties of the state to the individuals, and right in this long arc of history aiming towards injecting inherent human worth into the soldier by the government of the state. And then it just reaches a point where it's like, you know, you're reaching a point where you're humanized, like all this process of humanizing conflict, all these conventions and all these protocols to sort of make conflict humane. But it's like, where do you get to the point where it just becomes inherently contradictory to even fight the conflict in the first place? You've injected so much worth into the soldier, into the human, into the individual, that to waste it on something so meaningless, like two recent examples being the Nagorno-Karabakh regional conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan that occurred this year in the Tigray region in Ethiopia. It's just like, you know, there's better means, like this is where the dialogue, like there's better means to go about resolving the issue, like resolving your conflicts and disputes other than wasting the prowess of a human life on something so trivial. And I just feel like you're reaching the point where you've humanized something so much that it has risen above and has evolved beyond the need for any sort of armed conflict. It's just, it becomes inherently ridiculous at that point.
That's exactly Bertha's argument. Exactly that. And she actually had a very famous debate. And by the way, this is also, because now we're getting into something that we hoped we would get into, and we're doing it naturally and organically, which is very nice. And that is the fact that today, Human Rights Day, December 10th, is also the death of Alfred Nobel, of the Nobel Peace Prize. And so we, this team, has always sort of like acknowledged this connection between human rights and peace. And the early drafts of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights explicitly mention the connection between human rights and peace, that if peace is our goal, we have to recognize human rights, number one. Number two, with Nobel and Bertha von Suttner, you're making her argument, Michael, being the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She has a very famous debate with the first winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Henri Dunant, the founder of the International Committee of the Red Cross, from which we get the first Geneva Convention of 1964. And she argues exactly that, that, look, you are focused on humanizing war, and in the end, the only way to, quote, win, and she says it's just absurd. Like, what are you doing? Because now to even win anymore, you're going to have to actually target civilians. Like, that's the only way to have the adequate shock and awe. And so she's so prescient in her arguments. But so this is her famous debate with Henri Dunant about, you know, the way to end war is not through humanizing it like you're doing with the Geneva Conventions, but by just like abolishing it now. Because in the end, yeah, you have this like relic that's totally inconsistent with the very principles that are behind the Geneva Conventions and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights about, you know, the inherent dignity and worth, exactly. Yeah, so Tolstoy would go on to say that really, you know, human beings are, I've used this phrase before, drunk, he says intoxicated, that's the word he uses, and we're like in this state of cognitive dissonance. And like on the one hand, we have this like, you know, this sort of way that we uplift the human soul, and on the other hand, we have barbarism. And the way that you sort of get rid of that is to bring to consciousness that cognitive dissonance. And that's what the Kingdom of God is Within You is about, that, and how we hide that dissonance from ourselves through distraction, substances, and other things, right? So, yeah, your argument has been made. You're in that spirit. Anybody else?
Yeah, I wonder, going off this point, if one of the great purposes of the human rights, you know, putting them into words and trying to get them to be embraced by countries, by states, by individuals, and by communities, is to build the practice of empathy and the golden rule and sort of rebirth or reawaken people's humanity when it comes to these areas where they might otherwise have sort of, like you said, gotten drunk and forgotten about it. And I think when one starts to awaken themselves to the humanity of others and remind themselves that, like, we are all are a human family and that we have duties to one another, that by that practice, they will become more peaceful as a society, and they will demand their governments and their states become more peaceful. And as states learn to embrace and sort of restrict themselves, and really states are comprised of people, when the people in power learn to restrict themselves and are restricted by their people in a way that reflects humanity in their actions, I think then too they will become more peaceful. And I think, you know, that's sort of with humanitarian law and human rights and peace, like, it all goes hand in hand in a way, because, like, if we awaken ourselves to the humanity of others, our actions should follow. And, like, one of the things I think that you taught me, Hope, was about the golden rule principle and the little pin. And I remember the first day I wore the pin. I don't wear it anymore on a regular basis, but when I do, I find myself taking it off so much the first day or, like, the first time, because I'm like, I wasn't even aware that I was doing this thing that was against the golden rule, and just like being aware that you are doing something that is on like is not okay, that is against your humanity, I think is incredibly powerful, and that sort of awakens other activities and motivates your future actions, because it's a habit and it's a skill.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, and it's like that sort of practice and that awareness, I will say, you know, uncorks, and this is Jane Addams speak, uncorks deeper reservoirs and deeper channels of moral energy. And that is what is happening. And yeah, I really appreciate the reminder of these are all linked. The Geneva Conventions, peace, human rights. The first Geneva Convention, okay, like the story of that, it is a tactic to end war. And there's a quote, it's by Gustave Meunier, and it's something, and he worked alongside Henri Dunant. There was five of them. So if you don't think like five people can do something amazing, just look at the history of the first Geneva Convention. And Gustave Meunier says something like, the Geneva Convention, and we should say the first Geneva Convention, we've been talking about the third Geneva Convention, which has to do with the prisoners of war, but the first Geneva Convention has to do with the treatment of medics on the field. And the rule was, don't fire on them. That's it. Like, don't shoot the doctors, and the doctors take a vow of neutrality and impartiality in the conflict. They can't take sides. All the war wounded has to be treated equally, et cetera. And Gustave Meunier says something like, this is a, quote, secret agent of peace, because you're injecting into this conflict this, like, humane channel of you know, helping. And he said something like, with the right hand is slaying and the left hand is helping. And so you look at that contradiction, and that wakes you up, right? And so this is all, but of course Bertha disagreed. She thought that wasn't a good tactic to get to peace, that you should just like abolish war and create, you know, international courts. And again, like all these people disagree about what's the tactic that we use. But yeah, absolutely sort of like increasing our empathy, remembering that we're all part of the human family. Those are really important, sort of psychological, spiritual traits that need to be developed. Randy, I feel that you need to talk now.
Okay. Well, there's this, multi-generational project towards creating a civilization that harbors the preconditions for peace that has been happening for a long time. We talk about it every week, and, you know, we could talk about different components of it, but, you know, today's conversation has, you know, made it very clear to me that underneath it all, the whole project, the whole set of presuppositions, the whole plan is built on one specific principle, namely that, like, it's the word is dignity. That word is so loaded. It's so packed full of things. There's philosophies that took thousands of years to develop that are packaged into that term. And it's interesting because, you know, that word is in the preamble to the UDHR. That word is in Evelyn Grubb's thing we talked about today. Like, that this concept of dignity undergirds the whole project. And it's antithetical to like armed conflict and death, precisely because it makes it not reasonable in terms of basic economic cost benefit situations, right? We just weigh it up. If dignity is on the scale, you can't kill people if dignity is there. And so the whole framework is built on that, and it's really interesting to me, really fascinating that it came through in the way that it did today, and I'm just hoping I can make it clear to other people.
Cool. Yeah. Dignity, the worth of a human being. Indeed. Shining through it all. And we have mentioned the philosopher who I think gives the most sophisticated account of human dignity is Immanuel Kant. So have fun spending the rest of your life trying to understand him. because you need a lot of time to yourself to sit with his ideas. But in any case, there is a nice short book called Dignity, Its History and Meaning by Michael Rosen. I teach philosophy of law, and we focus on the concept of human dignity, and we use that small text if you want to dip your toe in that way. I do want to, a couple of you have mentioned, Michael, you mentioned the 1977 protocol to the Geneva Convention. You can actually link to that on our show resources page, and it's Article 32. It's like two sentences. Just go check out Article 32 of the 1977 protocol to the Geneva Convention. And it definitely says that there's the right of the families to know the truth about their loved ones in conflict. So that's there, and that's 1977, so 6 years after the Grubb family and other similarly situated families make this petition. Taylor, you I think also pointed out the sort of, how we, this petition and this making the claim and getting the idea out there is so important. And there is a thing called the right to truth now. You know, when you read the petition, you see different phrases like right to know with certainty. And it really, the right to truth is more of the sort of language that's used in international law now. And there is a Wikipedia page on it that you should check out to see the evolution of it. And it's really, when it's discussed in circles of international law, it's done in connection with the families of the disappeared. So, especially in Latin America, it's not attributed to the disappeared, like the POW missing in action. And we wanted on this show to sort of point to that connection, that in addition to the disappeared in Latin America, there's also the disappeared and the missing during armed conflict. And we thank the National League of POW MIA Families for moving us closer to a more humane plane. So I just wanted to mention that the right to truth and human rights, the Geneva Conventions, peace, truth, all connected, material for a future show maybe, and I'll stop and then open it up, and I'll start from the beginning of the alphabet again and start with you, Taylor, and work my way to Randy. But, fun fact. I'm pretty sure you guys, correct me. But 1948, is when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights comes into existence. Okay, December 10th. And Nobel Peace Prize. There was no Nobel Peace Prize in 1948. And that is because people thought it was going to go to Gandhi. And the Peace Prize is not awarded posthumously. You can't get it if you're dead. So there was no Peace Prize that year. Now, Gandhi's method is called Satyagraha, which means truth force. Okay, so there's all of these linkages that I just want to point to. Like, it's a knot that we need to untangle. So we have, if we go back to this moment in time, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights comes into existence. Gandhi has been assassinated. He's talking about the importance of truth and peace. Evelyn Grubb's petition, 1971, talking about the right to truth. Okay, so I just want you to sort of mull over all of those connections, and then we're in our concluding part of the show. So if you have any concluding remarks or remarks to add to what has just been said, please do so now, and we will start with Taylor.
So I think what's so interesting is this idea of through nonviolence, with Satyagraha, we can we can discover the truth. And in a way, I think that Evelyn Grubb's petition was like a nonviolent action. And I think that's like inherently what these petitions and laws are, is a way to discover the truth and to use nonviolence. Like, we've established these laws as a nonviolent means. I mean, you're the professor. Like, you could probably explain philosophy of law so much better, but I feel like the idea of, you know, we've progressed since the point where people had to fight their own sort of like battles, and right now, or to use violence to fight their battles. And we've developed these systems where people can find out the truth and establish their rights and in through nonviolent means. And, you know, we don't want to go back to that point where people feel like they can't use the legal system internationally or nationally to find out the truth. And sort of for peace, we have to have the truth, because, like, if you think about it on the most basic level, if someone steals your cow and you don't know who's stolen your cow, you might, like, break into their property to steal their cow. I remember a CivPro professor explaining that as, like, the reason we have the law. It was, like, my first law school class. Of, like, you don't want people to go search for their truth or revenge themselves. And so, like, I feel like that's, like, the basic idea of, like, sort of law and society is, like, one of the basic ideas is people have to understand what happened. And, like, the government has to, and the government international sort of structures have to give them a solution. Otherwise, they will resort to, like, vigilante justice and violence themselves. And so I think, like, truth is fundamental to establishing a peaceful society.
Yeah. So peace through law and the truth involved in that process. Absolutely. Cool. And Michael?
Through this show, I think, as we have done throughout this whole Duty to Remember miniseries series, it really just shows, for one, how incredible of an individual Evelyn Grubb was. I think this her petition to the United Nations really speaks to, and all that has resulted, I would say, from that really speaks to the profound drive, the moral energy that she had, and how truly, deeply and passionately she felt about these really profound issues. And through our Duty to Remember Facebook page, we have the honor of being in contact with all of the Grubb children. Oh, which, by the way, if you have not checked it out, definitely go check out the Duty to Remember Facebook page, post for the show, and lots of other resources can be found there. But through the posting for this week's show, one of the Grubb children, Roy Grubb, commented, "My mother fought for the rights for all POWs, MIA, Vietnamese included." So it really speaks to this, that it's this one human family, that the work put in does not only benefit the families from the United States, but families who have lost individuals or who have individuals who have gone missing in all armed conflicts all around the world. And I think, you know, I think it speaks to our ability to take something like Evelyn Grubb's petition to the United Nations, and we focus on something so specific, but then it serves as this catalyst for more profound, broader questions and thoughts, which we got to more so in the second half of the show. And I think we all really hit upon that a lot of this might seem complex and convoluted when you see it through the larger abstractions of individuals like the United Nations and all these other various international facets. But at its core, it's all about recognizing everyone's basic humanity or human dignity. And a quote that had came to mind was Thomas Nagel from The Possibility of Altruism: "You are one among many, equally real." And through that recognition of everyone's humanity and through cultivating within yourself compassion and through the examination of yourself, that you will be able to lead a more kind-hearted and virtuous life.
Cool. Randy?
Well, you know, we talk about this on large scales, and I'm going to, as has become custom, try to bring it down to the level of the individual. That's my niche now. You know, I haven't been around that long, but I've been around long enough to solve a few problems in my life. And one of the main things that's always been a prerequisite to solving any problem was having the right information, you know? Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the family, right, if you're trying to determine what to do about the head of household being missing, it's very different than knowing or than trying to create a solution to whether or not the head of household is dead. Like, those are not the same thing. And so, you know, this is just, it's a problem, and the information is part of the solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. And every individual has the same set of needs when it comes to dealing with reality. Like, you have to address the facts as they are. If you're not doing that, you're doing something very destructive, as far as I can tell, in every mm-hmm. situation. So, like, this right to truth, it's not new. It's something that we've always needed. And, of course, there's a degree of falsification to the world. That's not the point. The point is, you know, individuals can't actually do anything productive without truthful information. And so we have to create conditions for that information to be available. And cool. Turns out our civilization is doing the best that it can.
Yeah, and I'll just conclude by saying sometimes the accurate information is that there is uncertainty. There's a whole area of grief called ambiguous loss. And this is like the not knowing. And this doesn't just happen in cases of the missing, but also people who are right in front of you and maybe suffering from dementia, okay? Because you have a case of the person's there, they're not there, and there's this like uncertainty as to what the day is going to be like. And so I would say also that in addition to the truth, we have to also learn how to, and I think, Randy, you have made this point, deal with uncertainty in a graceful manner. I also want to say that, and again, like echoing Michael's praise for Evelyn Grubb's character and the fortitude, deep love, right? Which is not one of the cardinal virtues. I would say it's like, you know, identified as a Christian virtue, but clearly love, which other peace activists have tried to channel into the world. But on this show, you know, we've been talking about the duty to remember, the missing, and I also want to add into that, like we don't just have a duty to remember those stories, but also what we on this show have repeatedly referred to as positive history. And that really is the history of these individuals. These individuals who have labored, Bertha von Suttner, Evelyn Grubb, right? Because in coming into contact with their stories, they create a clearing. They create an image of a person that we can strive to become. And so that's what we try to do on this show, is uncover these very specific stories of positive history. And I will say that we absolutely have a duty to remember those stories. So you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. We will likely be back next week on a similar theme, because as we said today, this is also the death of Alfred Nobel, and there are more linkages to be discussed amongst human rights and peace. So we will likely be back next week talking about those things. So good night, everyone. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Check out our show resources page and our other shows on these topics. Goodbye.